the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.
Welcome to the September 20th edition of Education Now. I am your host, Athena Melville, and it is my great pleasure to share an interview with Phil Cantor, a science teacher at North Grand High School on the northwest side of Chicago. Phil is a member of Teachers for Social Justice and CODE, also known as Communities Organized for Democracy in Education, and he was a strike captain during the recent Chicago strike, which ended Tuesday, September 18th. Philip Cantor received his bachelor's in psychology from Grinnell College, his teaching certification from the GATE Alternative Certification Program at Northwestern University, and he is currently completing his master's in education policy at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Phil holds teaching endorsements in science and social science and teaches biology, environmental science, and AP psychology. He also serves on the instructional leadership team at North Grand and is currently the chairman of the science department. He began teaching in 2002 after a career in multimedia production for business and nonprofit organizations. He currently lives in the Logan Square neighborhood in Chicago with his wife, a clinical psychologist, and his three daughters who attend a Chicago public school. Chicago public school teachers are returning to the classroom 9 days after launching their first strike in a quarter century. On the 18th, 800 delegates of the Chicago Teachers Union voted overwhelmingly to suspend the strike and put an agreement with the city before the entire membership. During her interview on Democracy Now! September 19th edition, Karen Lewis, president of the Chicago Teachers Union, said, quote, "We are trying to have people understand that when people come together to deal with problems of education, the people that are actually working in the schools need to be heard. And I think that this has been an opportunity for people across the nation to have their voices heard. I think we're moving in the right direction. I think the teachers across the country realize how important it is to stand up as a union together and fight back against things that are actually bad for children." End of quote. Education Now's interview with Phil Cantor was recorded on Friday, September 14th. And away we go. Hello and welcome, Phil Cantor, to the broadcast podcast waves of Education Now.
Hi, Athena. I'm very glad to be here. Thanks for asking.
Yes, I know that I've told the listeners about you. They know that you're a strike captain for the Chicago Teachers Union, and I want feedback from you about everything that's happened today. This is the fifth day when we're recording this. So how did the day go?
The day went great. The whole strike, really, while it was a difficult decision for us to come to, it's going great in terms of, from the union's point of view and from the teacher's point of view, and we think from the point of view of our students and parents in the communities where we teach. An article just came out today in the Sun-Times, you know, one of the two big papers in Chicago, basically saying that the union strategies were the right strategies in this strike, and they've achieved multiple goals through the strike. Support for the strike has actually increased as it got longer.
Yeah.
Among registered voters and especially among parents of students in CPS schools. Support was over 66% for parents in CPS, which is remarkable.
Yes, it is remarkable. I read that. I read that article in the Sun-Times, and I was so pleased because media really hasn't been that supportive of the teachers. And
yeah,
so,
no, overall, some of the media has been terrible and sort of ignorant, not even addressing any of the real issues. The
right.
New York Times ran an editorial that really was simplistic, you know.
It was.
Yeah, but, you know, the more people know about it, the more local they are, the more they're actually hearing about what's going on here, the more support we're getting.
Well, I saw a map, and it looks like you have support across the entire United States, across the nation, and in other countries as well.
That's meant a lot. As reports come in and through social media, we see people from Canada and from France and from Texas and from New York holding rallies to support us and sending pictures or creating photographs to send of people holding up signs. It really makes a huge difference. The teachers here are, you know, those of us who have been very involved in the issues know that these are national issues and even international issues that we're fighting for. We're not fighting for a raise.
No.
Despite what the media says. And, you know, the more kind of support we get from other places, I think that really reinforces that for people here in Chicago.
Yes, you don't go into teaching to make a lot of money.
Right.
And that's never been the goal of teachers. And I was just so excited that at this last big union gathering that there was some real effort to break through, because I really feel like 25 years ago, and that was the last time that you had a strike, right?
That's right. Yep.
That there were compromises made that were not in the best interest of the student. And I was really annoyed because I knew that that wasn't how teachers felt.
That's right.
And so I was just so happy to see Weingarten speak out and say, no, sir, you know, we are putting the children first and their best interest first and the parents. And I think that created a huge swell of support for the unions. I've always supported the unions, but I have been frustrated.
I have to tell you, I've been teaching for about 10 years now, and when I first joined the union, when I first started teaching, I had to join the union. I didn't really have a strong opinion about unions at that time. But I was actually sort of embarrassed by my union. The leadership seemed small, like they weren't thinking about the students. They were thinking small. They weren't thinking in the big picture. They were the kind of union that, you know, just fought for grievances and, you know, would publish stories about, you know, we got this person 3 years of back pay because of this thing that happened. And grievances are important, and we have to hold administrators accountable. But that's all they did. And it just didn't seem right. It didn't seem like they were supporting what most members cared about, which was being able to do our jobs.
Yes.
And they made some compromises. They let class size get out of control.
Yes.
Hold the board accountable for providing the right number of social workers and the right number of nurses and things
yes.
like that for our students. And literally, whenever I heard anything about the union in a previous administration, I was not a proud union member at all. But that completely changed when the current leadership, which is CORE, sort of started becoming active in the union. That's Karen Lewis and Jesse Sharkey and the group of people who are leading the union now. Even before they were in the leadership, they started acting like they were sort of in the leadership. They started creating events to bring attention to some of these issues. They started, really bringing people's consciousness around to what was going on in schools. And in doing so, a lot of teachers started to sort of wake up and realize that if we want a union that we're proud of, that it's us. We have to be that union. So it really started to turn things around. And when they finally ran for leadership positions in the union, they won by quite a big margin. And it was awesome. And, I would say, 26,000 people agree with me now that we're proud members of this union because we think it's fighting for what we went into teaching to do.
Yes, well, I can tell you I've been following the Chicago Teachers Union now for a good part of this year, and I am terrific. I am so proud of all of you and so grateful because I think that what you have done is for really the nation's children by bringing this to the attention. And I just felt like, when I started this radio show, when I started Education Now, it was in a direct response to this because I could not believe that, best practices, what's important for the student was not at the center, even though all of the child growth and development experts say that. And then when Bill Gates and all these business people came out and with this rhetoric and the media wasn't bringing any of the experts in child growth and development forward. They weren't even bringing experienced teachers forward.
That's right. The people taking the lead in education reform are business people. They're, people who think of it as a business model and think of children as widgets in a factory and teachers as sort of interchangeable parts in some machine. And those of us who have been in a classroom and tried to teach children know that that's the farthest thing from the truth. Here in Chicago, talking about it being a national issue, the reason we're in this conflict with the district in the first place goes back to when Mayor Emanuel and some Republicans in the state legislature and some Democrats in the state legislature passed a law. Pretty much the whole state legislature passed a law called SB7, which they thought made it virtually impossible for us to strike. It put an unreasonably high limit on what we had to, how many people had to vote to authorize the strike. And they thought it was impossible. There is a great video you can see online of Jonah Edelman from the group Stand for Children. I don't know, have you seen that video?
I have seen it, and I am just... Stand for Children,
right.
I've told my listeners, Stand for Children. Ugh.
Yeah,
beware, beware.
Children.
Yeah, Stand on Children. Beware, beware.
It's sad because, I believe many of these people went into education reform because they really wanted to help people. I really believe that. I don't think that these are evil people, but the way that it has sort of unfolded and the way once they started getting the big money from Gates and from Broad and from Walton and these foundations, it's morphed into this monster. And Jonah Edelman literally said, we laid it out here. We dropped $3 million in Chicago in a period of months, not in Chicago, but in Springfield, in the capital of Illinois, to pass a law that makes it impossible to strike, gives the mayor sole discretion to change the school day. And he believed that that would basically break the union. He hired up all the lobbyists and the attorneys that the union ordinarily would hire for negotiations so that they were on retainer so the union couldn't even have people to hire to work on this fight. And when I saw that happen, I was very disheartened. My thought was, Rahm Emanuel is playing chess and I'm here in this union that thinks it's a checkers game. But I was proven wrong on that because
yeah.
Karen Lewis and the leadership saw what was going on. I think they did have to adjust, and there was a learning curve, but they didn't give up, and they figured out ways around the worst parts of that law, and they did it through old-fashioned grassroots organizing. They got parents on our side. They got teachers on our side. I mean, there was an amazing gathering a couple of was a couple of months ago, we all went to the auditorium theater. We packed it. It seats 4,000, and then there were about 10,000 more people outside. And that was our first big, giant march. And at that point, we realized, and that was before the vote to authorize the strike, right? So it was showing us that we were strong. Right.
Yes.
It wasn't just showing Rahm that we were strong. It was showing us that we were strong.
Yes.
And people walked away from that and told those who didn't show up, man, you missed something. This
right.
is big.
It empowered the teachers. It empowered the parents.
That's right.
And it empowered the students.
That's right.
I got some little videos of that. I was so, Kip Dawson sent them to me, and I was just so tickled. And,
it was amazing.
Oh, yes, it looked amazing. It was just so wonderful. It's just so exciting, and I'm just so glad this is happening. And I know that, you know, you don't feel that these are dark characters, but, you know, the Koch brothers, it's a...
Well, I wasn't talking about them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think sometimes people become dark characters. I really think most people don't go into education reform to destroy schools and hurt kids, you know. They go into it thinking they're helping. Because they have what is now sort of a common sense idea that the best way to fix schools is to privatize them and give parents choice. That whole choice mantra is so upsetting. When you look at great schools around the world, they're in systems where all the schools are public, like Finland,
that's right.
where every
yes.
school is public. Or, you know, Massachusetts has great schools in the United States. They're public schools. They're union schools. Nobody's opening charters in nice neighborhoods, you know.
No.
And it's
no,
not
I know my granddaughters go to school in the Bay Area, in the Palo Alto area, and they are fantastic schools. But
yeah,
not only
well funded.
Right, yeah. But not only did they say no to Prop 13, our taxes will continue going to our schools.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, then they did this whole thing where, you know, there were parents who had a different philosophies and wanted, you know, so they created a lot of different philosophies and gave parents choice that way, but still the teachers created it.
That's right.
The unions are strong, but in the poverty-ridden areas, and I think that you're teaching in a poverty-ridden area, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all of Chicago public schools, it's about 85% low-income district-wide. My school and many schools are way over 90% poverty.
Right.
You know, 94%, right. 95% poverty is typical.
Right. So instead of going to these areas where it's working really well, like Palo Alto and like the Massachusetts schools you're talking about, why didn't they go there? I've been yelling about this. Why don't you go to the models that are working so well and see what they're doing instead of this business model? And really, this business model, this taking teaching out of the caring profession, started in the 80s with Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the caring professions are going through this defamation of character. All of the unions are. And so I'm just so glad we're all fighting back. And I know that a lot of the Occupy movement is strongly behind what's happening now, and I think that's also very exciting.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. I mean, they've been at all the rallies. They've been on the social media sites. They've been promoting what's going on. There's a great publication here in Chicago called the Occupied Chicago Tribune, which is like an alternative newspaper, and they did a whole issue just on the teacher strike.
Uh-huh.
It was brilliant. They did a story on educational apartheid. The front cover is, you know, just says solidarity, and you see, you know, a photograph of streets packed with people in red shirts marching.
Right.
It's a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful thing. When I think of the work of Jonathan Cozzol and how intimately he knows this subject, and that his word, after all of his life and experience, that they don't even give him the respect to say, oh, well, look what Jonathan's been doing all this work all these years. We should listen to him.
That's right.
And so I'm just so frustrating. I'm just so excited.
But yeah, there are really positive things going on, and that's what we need to build on. There's a rap artist here in Chicago who went to Chicago Public Schools, and he must have turned this around in 2 or 3 days. He came out with a great song called Chicago Teacher. And I can send you the link to it. Maybe you can post
that would be good. I have posted it, but I will put it in the promotion for this show so that a lot more people get to hear
that song. When was the last time you heard the words neoliberal privatization in a rap song?
I never.
Right?
Never. Oh, it was brilliant.
Yeah, it is absolutely brilliant. I mean, he covers the issues in a sophisticated way.
Yes, he does.
It's a beautiful, and he was a Chicago Public School student.
And he makes that very clear.
Yeah.
Which is also really wonderful, really wonderful. There was a great article in called Testing Companies Are Robbing Public Education and the Nation's Children. From Alternet, and I just thought, this is so true. And that's another huge issue. You know, all of that money that's going to these testing companies, to Pearson.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, it's criminal. That money could be spent on the children, on reducing the student-faculty ratio, on the arts, which, all psychologists know that the arts are this great way of expressing, your feelings when you're going through hard times. And this is especially important for these kids who are in extreme poverty.
Yeah, absolutely.
And are they going to, is it part of the bargain that they're going to reduce the student-faculty ratio?
No. No, unfortunately, it's not.
So you're still going to have 40 some students?
Hopefully not. I mean, I haven't seen the final language. What I heard most recently was that at least we were going to still have language in the contract that had a target class size of about 30 per class, with some money for I believe there's language in the contract that says there is going to be class size of around 30 students per class, but it's still not something we can grieve about, right? So if I do have 40 students in my class, which I do, right now I have one class that's 41 students. The woman who also teaches biology with me at North Grand has three classes, each with more than 40 students in biology. We can't file a grievance about that. We can't force them to change it. What is in the contract now, I believe, though, is language that says you can notify an official who will then investigate it, and there is about $2.5 million district-wide that they will spend to try to mitigate these things. But $2.5 million in a district our size means that's going to pay for the few staff people to actually investigate these things.
Right.
There's not really money to change positions, but
as late as the 80s, I had research that was clear that when you go beyond 1 to 17, retention drops by 70%.
Wow.
Do you have an aide? Are you alone in that classroom with 41?
No, in that class, I do have somebody with me because it is a special ed inclusion class. So I have 41 students, 12 of whom have, IEPs. So they have, mandated special ed services in that class.
Right, yes.
But, inclusion is wonderful. It's great to have special ed kids with regular ed kids working together. But you need a small class to do that effectively.
And yes, you do.
You also need the special ed specialist in there to work with you to help those kids work together. But in a class of 41, that's in a classroom that's designed for a maximum of 32, there's just nowhere to put kids. They're like on top of each other. I'm a science teacher, so they're at lab tables. So they're crowded, and it's hard. You can't pay attention to what's going on in class, to your work, if you're shoulder to shoulder with other teenagers.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult. And Yeah, so 41 students, 12 of whom have special needs, and a couple of whom have really severe cognitive deficits and learning disabilities. So they really need personal attention from me or from the special ed teacher, but they can't because there's just too many gosh darn kids in there. So I'm saying that we have not gotten a great improvement in class size, but here's what we fought for. I mean, we were fighting for that, but here's what we got. At least it's still in the contract. What CPS wanted to do was remove all language relating to class size from the contract, so there would be nothing about it. And they wanted to replace that and all of the other specific workplace language with one paragraph that said, and, you know, the CPS board, at its discretion, will make decisions about educational matters. And that was it. So they wanted to say, basically, if it's not covered in the contract, we'll just tell you what you're going to do about it. And they wanted to take all of those things out. So nothing about class size, nothing about temperature in the rooms, nothing about, I mean, our contract, unfortunately, is like 200 pages long because it needs to be. There's language in the contract that says teachers have to have access to a Xerox machine. Not that we get to make copies on it, but at least that we have access to it. They can limit how many copies we have. But it had to be put in there because there were a lot of schools where no matter what you wanted to do, you could not get to a copy machine to actually format some copies or make some copies. So that's in the contract, you know. So people think it's just about money and benefits, and really it's about teaching conditions.
Right. Yes, I know that it's about teaching conditions. And I can't even believe that you have to fight to get copies. And then they ask you to be responsible for how well these children perform.
Right.
Now, that's another thing, you know, the research on the best indicator of how a student will do in school and in life is a teacher's recommendation. So if that's the best indicator, you know, then how come they even have these stupid tests?
Right, right. I can learn a lot more by talking about a student with a teacher who had that student in class than I can learn from looking at a test score.
Right.
No doubt about it.
And you can take that money and reduce that class size and get an aide in there with you. And
that's
really
right.
Give those kids a quality education. That's what it should be about. And these
right.
charter schools that are for profit that Rahm Emanuel wants to start up, how much is that going to cost?
I think it's for next year they have about, I want to say, $70 million. I don't have the numbers in front of me. $70 million toward charter expansion, but that was just in the last budget. But then they use other money for, like, you know, building fund money and things like that. The Chicago school budget is not terribly transparent, right? So they have other staffing budgets and things like that that can go to charters as well. So, it used to be the idea was that charters received less state money than regular schools, slightly less, and that they had to sort of raise their own funds to make up the difference. And that's been changing more and more lately, too. Charters are complaining that it's not fair that they don't get the same money that regular public schools get, when in fact they end up spending much more per student because they do get a lot of private money as well from Gates and Broad and other philanthropies. So they spend more per student. Their success rates are not as good as neighborhood schools for the most part, yet they're seen as a solution.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I support charter schools that are started by parents and teachers. They're not chains. They're a response to a situation that just was just too difficult for them to deal with. And so teachers do not make as much money as if they were teaching in the public system, but at least from their perspective, they can do what they know is right for the students. And parents, you know, they know that they don't maybe won't have the greatest facility, but they know that they're getting what they want for their children. Now, I can support that, I do support that. I don't support these charter chain schools that are all about drill and kill. And I see that those are the kinds of charter schools that they're putting in these areas of poverty.
Right.
The kind of charter schools I'm talking about are not in those areas.
Right. I see what you're saying. I mean, there are a few really interesting charter schools. There are charter schools based on African culture, for example, in the Chicago South Side, which is all African American. There's a charter that is based on sort of a curriculum of Black culture and Black pride, which is awesome, right?
Yes.
They're trying something different. They're trying to shape curriculum around the culture of their students, and that is something that, you know, most people who teach about education would say is a great idea. There's the University of Chicago Charter Schools, which are really tied closely to the university, and they get great research, and they get a lot of support from the university and the professors. Right, but these are not the schools that are sort of designed to create a free market.
Right.
And my concern, even with that other type of school,
mm-hmm.
is that what it does is basically, it can harm the neighborhood schools that it's near. I see this with the other kind of charter school, but it would still be true for a charter school that isn't part of a big chain and is pedagogically sound, is that it takes the most motivated families out of the neighborhood school.
I see.
Because they're motivated to go find that other place and do the paperwork to get their kid into it, right? And one problem with the other charters that are opening up, too, is that they also push kids out, right? They're not allowed to select their students, but they accept them in, and then they push them out.
Mm-hmm.
If they're behavior problems, they push them out. If they have learning disabilities, they push them out. If they have language difficulties, they push them out. There's one charter chain in Chicago which fines students. So if you don't wear a belt with your uniform, it's $5. If you don't look a teacher in the eye when you speak to them, it's $5. If you don't have your shirt tucked in, it's $5. And these are teenagers, right?
No, I don't know. The research is out there. The research is right there. You don't have to go very far to find it, that these punitive measures do not work.
Well, it works for the charter school, which wants to push that kid out, because when the fines get to be about $250, they leave the school. Right, they build up these fines because
I see. So that's
them.
How they're getting rid of them.
That's right. I see kids show up in my classroom junior year before the ACT exam, like a month or two before the ACT exam, show up in my school, and I say, "Oh, hey, what school did you come from?" And they say, "Oh, I came from that charter school." And I'm like, "Oh, how come you changed schools?" And I said, "Yeah, I couldn't deal with paying all that money for fines, and they treat you like crap over there, and blah blah blah." So. It is a way for them to keep their test scores up, right? Push out the kids that are difficult.
Right, yeah.
And then we get their test scores.
Right.
Up in our school, right? So.
Right. And, you know, test scores, well, you know
back
how
to
I
what
feel.
What you were saying about
yeah.
test scores. It's
yeah,
a terrible measure.
It's just a terrible measure. And here you have, you know, these kids who are being fined and tossed out, they need restorative. They need to be, you know, they need restorative intervention.
Right. They need lessons that are interesting that they'll want to do.
Right. And a psychologist that will, you know, come into the situation and find out what's, you know, what's bugging that kid and help in the integration of the process instead of punitive, you know, like, we're going to fine you. How about compassion and caring? I mean, that's what education is supposed to be about.
Right.
And so, you know, test scores are just they're so stupid. And we know that carrots and sticks don't work. All the research is there that, you know, giving people a little piece of candy or whatever for their work, that just doesn't work. It has to be.
It's counterproductive. It's not just that it doesn't help, that it actually harms their internal motivation.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
So what else will the union gain from this from their negotiation with Ron Emanuel?
So we've gotten, you know, a lot of the things that CPS was trying to just completely take off the table altogether, like class size, is still going to be in the contract, we can still kind of keep pushing on it. It's going to take time, but we can still work on it. And it's even though it's not a great protection, it's a protection. You were talking about the arts earlier.
Yes.
The union pulled off a fantastic deal, and this was before the strike even happened. It was sort of an effort to avert the strike. Excuse me. It was an effort to avert the strike. Rahm Emanuel wanted to lengthen the school day. This was his big push. It was a campaign promise of his. So he got the state legislature to make a law that said he could extend the school day. And the first thing he did pretty much when he got into office was he declared a financial emergency and denied teachers a 4% raise that they had already been contractually obliged to get, right? So the city was obliged to pay us a 4% raise, which he took away immediately. So the teachers weren't especially happy, but he figured, well, they can't strike anyway because of this law, so it doesn't matter. And then the next thing he did was he tried to increase the school day by an hour and a half without budgeting anything for that additional time. So not only wasn't he going to pay for any extra programming or any extra materials, but he wasn't going to pay people to work for an extra, you know, to add 20% to their day on the clock, right? So it was a huge offense. It was, you know, just
it's a disgusting.
Right, but I think it was calculated to get the union to portray the union in a bad light. Because if we complained about it, we were seen as being lazy. Oh, we don't want to work an extra hour and a half.
Right.
Which was not true, because we all worked that extra hour and a half anyway.
Oh.
Or greedy, like, why, you know, we want 20% more money if you're going to put 20% more time on the clock. So it was, I think, a political move to portray the union as greedy and or lazy, right? So he tried to push that through, and there was great resistance, and there was a part of the process leading up to a potential strike was to have a neutral mediator hear both sides and then issue a fact-finding report. And I assume you heard about this. The mediator report, when the mediator's report came out, it was solidly on the side of the union. It said, Rahm Emanuel caused this problem. He caused this impasse by extending the workday by an hour and a half without paying anything for it. That's completely ridiculous. It's against everything we believe in America, you know, about fair pay and it was great. And the compromise that Rahm and Karen came up with, what they struck, was that the length of the students' day would be somewhat longer, about an hour longer, at the grammar school level. At the high school level, we already had a 7-hour day, 7:15 or something like that. But the way that most schools worked in Chicago is the teacher's lunch, rather than being in the middle of the day, 45-minute duty-free lunch, was at the end of the day. So they got their lunch after the students left. But that made the day very rushed, and it cut out recess for a lot of students. So they took the teacher's lunch and they put it back in the middle of the day, which is where it belonged, which was a good thing. And the way that they worked the extra time is the mayor promised to hire about 500 more teachers to teach art and music and physical education and foreign languages to cover teachers during their lunch and their prep times while the kids were at recess or, you know, things like that. So I don't know. The problem is the logistics, of course, don't work, because you might have 30 teachers in a building who all need that extra hour of coverage so that they can have their prep time or their lunch in the middle of the day. So it doesn't really work to have one individual doing that for so many teachers. So that's part of, I think, what they've been ironing out with this contract, too. But so the idea was teachers are not going to work a longer day on the clock actually teaching. They'll be there longer because we'll move their unpaid lunch to the middle of the day. But the students' extended day then would actually include some art and music and library and technology and things like that. And that's what the union made that happen. So the union's pushing for a fuller curriculum, a richer curriculum, was, you know, I think that is a big gain that we made even before the strike happened.
Oh, yes, that's a really wonderful gain. I was so excited to hear about that, and I'm glad that that's in there, and I hope that logistically it really works and it's not just words on paper.
I hope so, too. I know in some schools it is working pretty well, and in other schools it's a disaster. Partly because it was, you know, in typical CPS style, they just dictated, well, this is what you will do, do it. And you're like, wait, I have to arrange schedules of 900 students and 65 teachers and X number of classrooms and only one gym and a cafeteria that's only big enough for two classes. And right, they don't think about what some of these things do. Rahm Emanuel went to school on the North Shore of Chicago. He went to high school at New Trier, which is one of the top schools in the country, where they have two television stations and six different orchestras. And, you know, where students their last 2 years basically design their own programs and their own schedules and do
right.
independent study. And, you know.
The best.
Best. And where they spend about $24,000 per year per student, compared to like less than half of that we spend in Chicago. So I don't think he can conceive of what it's like to actually be a principal in a Chicago public school and have to deal with what he passes down to them. You know, I really respect principals that can pull it off and deal with what they get from upstairs while they're, you know, dealing with everything that they have to with teachers and students and parents and the community. It's an amazing thing. But a lot of, you know, there are principals who can't handle it. And, you know, the chaos from above really affects the students unless there's a great principal that can really insulate teachers and students from it.
Yeah. I feel like they should be making so much more money just because they have this to deal with. They have these students whose self-concept really needs to be encouraged and nurtured, and instead of, you know, tested.
Right.
And they should be making even more money than those teachers who are teaching in schools where the parent cares and where, you know, there's enough food on the table and children,
right.
you know, aren't stressing. You know, it's all backwards.
It is backwards, yeah.
Yeah.
The schools that Rahm went to actually have the highest paid teachers in the state.
Of course.
Many of them make over $100,000 a year, and they have a much smaller teaching load. You know, we teach generally five classes of, you know, 30-plus kids, and they teach four classes of, you know, 25 kids or 24 kids.
Right.
And if they teach an AP class or a lab class, then they, you know, have even fewer classes and fewer students, you know, whereas we just get more.
That's right. It's so backwards. Is any of this addressed? I mean, what else is there anything else you feel that the union really gained from strike?
Yeah, reducing the emphasis on standardized testing for teacher evaluation.
Yay! Oh, that is huge.
It's been shown over and over to be detrimental to teaching and learning.
It's
a narrow curriculum and you know, evaluate teachers very unreliably when it's used. And so we really have fought for that, and I think that's been pretty well taken care of. Like I said, they're still working out the details. they're finishing their negotiations tomorrow, I think, and then on Sunday, the final proposal will be brought to the Union Board of Delegates, who will review at the House of Delegates.
They're not going to have this the teachers' evaluation be based on the students' test scores, but are they going to have all of the testing anyway? Are they still going to be tested?
I would really love to find out. And let me be clear: I think they are still going to have to include some student test scores in teacher evaluations, because of the Illinois law, SB 7, which requires that is the case for Chicago. So that law, that aspect of the law only applies to Chicago, not other districts in the state. So the Illinois law says that teachers have to be evaluated partly by student growth measures, right? So will it be a standardized test or will it be some other growth measure remains to be seen. That they're working out those details now, I think.
They're hammering that out as we speak, probably.
As we speak right now. So hopefully by the time your listeners hear this, we'll know more details. Maybe we'll have an update. But what they did do is they didn't tie it to teacher pay, because that was the other thing that was in the original proposal. That's what the board wanted to do, was to tie test scores to pay for teachers, which makes things even worse, right? If teachers are apt to teach to the test because it affects the way they're evaluated, they're going to teach to the test even more if it means they may or may not get a raise that year. So that's definitely a good thing that we got out of there. The last big sticking issue is for teachers who are laid off, not who are fired or have bad evaluations, but who are laid off because a school is closed or enrollment goes down, they're trying to get teachers a right to be in a pool that can be hired back before principals can hire from outside. So it's basically job security, but we'll see on that one. That's still very up in the air.
Yeah, I hope that comes through. This argument for me that I never hear is, how can we base a teacher's evaluation on these test scores if the student's needs have not been met? If the student's needs, and talking about child growth and development, have not been met, then how can you blame the teacher?
Right. I have a school with 1,000 students, roughly, and there's 2/5 of a social worker, right? Social worker is only there 2 days a week, and that's only because the law says there has to be a social worker for the kids who have special ed services, so that social worker can only work with those kids. So for the vast majority of my students, there is no social worker that they can see. Last year, in students just in my classes, I had 3 students tell me about violent deaths in their immediate family. It's a violent city, and their neighborhoods are some of the worst. And, how can you expect a kid? I mean, I had a kid come to school the day after her brother was stabbed, and she seemed down, and I said, "What's going on?" I thought maybe she broke up with the boyfriend or something like that, and she said, "I lost my brother yesterday." But she came to school. She was in my AP psychology class.
It was probably something she needed to come. Isn't that something? But then if she doesn't perform well on a test, you are going to you would be looked at as the reason instead of her life.
Right, her life, and just the fact that there was no support for her. I mean,
yes.
Teachers tried to step up, and teachers helped her out, and the community kind of tried to rise up and help out. But it's different from actually being able to see a psychologist and see a social worker and have a social worker help your family get services.
Right.
I have kids who can't see, and they have vision testing until December, and then the kids get glasses in January, and they don't wear them because they haven't been wearing them all year.
Right.
Things
like that, that you just, I want that to end. I want to see education working for these children. I want to see it so badly.
Yeah, I do too. And I mean, part of it means we have to go back and change that law, because the law in Springfield, and ROM is going to try to change it. We know that the corporate reformers are going to try to change that law to make it illegal for us to strike at all. We need to change that law to make it legal for us to strike over things other than pay. That law that he got passed says that the only thing that is strikeable is compensation. Again, to make the union look greedy if we go on strike, or if we try to strike. In his view, I don't think he even believed we could get 70% of our membership, 75% of our membership to vote to authorize. We got 98% of our membership to vote to authorize.
Yeah, that was impressive.
It was incredible. The only thing we are allowed to strike about is compensation, legally. If we went out on strike over class size and said that that's why we were going on strike, we could all be fired.
If you went on strike for class size, and that you need to have counselors for your students, and that you need to have an outlet for all of the problems that they're having, and that you want to follow the guidelines of child growth and development experts in your classrooms for these children, you can't go out on strike on that. That's what you're telling me.
That would be illegal. Yep.
That is just disgusting. I want to fight that. If there is any way possible that I can help fight that, I want to be there to do it. I am
absolutely
just outraged.
And it's not just Illinois. When Stand for Children came and got that law passed in Illinois, they said it was going to be a model for the rest of the country.
I'm sure.
It's a model, and in Jonah Edelman's words, he said, it's a model to ram it down their throats in, you know, cities around the country. So it is. That is what the strike was really about. And yes, it was about compensation because that's what we had to strike about. But what I'm so proud of our union is they brought all these other issues to the front. And they would not talk about compensation until these other issues were dealt with. So, and I know Rahm, I mean, I have a feeling he's going to try to declare the strike illegal. He's going to try to use... he's going to say the contract is so expensive, therefore I'm going to cut more schools. He's going to continue fighting, and you know he's a powerful guy. So we have to fight. We have to be ready for this. They're going to try to change the law, and not just in Illinois. They're going to say, look what happened in Chicago when we change your law in Ohio or California or New York. Let's make sure they can't strike.
Yes, in Florida.
Florida. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Jeb Bush. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Oh.
Just... Well, and you were talking about testing. I counted up 15 days of standardized testing this year for our students. 15 days, 3 weeks of school. Part of that, I hope, now goes away, because if they're not evaluating teachers as much on test scores, they can get rid of some of these interim tests that they were going to use to measure us. These aren't tests that are even supposed to help the children. They're supposed to just measure the teachers, you know. So hopefully we can get rid of some of those days. I really hope so.
I hope so, too. The other thing that I wish that parents, I keep saying it, but of course, you know, reaching the parents that need to hear it, they can opt out of these tests.
Yeah.
These are not the state's children.
That's right.
They can opt out of these tests. And that so needs to be done. That just needs to be done. The people who are doing these tests, who are creating these tests, just like a lot of the textbooks that are written by people who do not have the best interest of we the people in mind, and especially of these people that you're serving.
Right.
They
right.
don't.
No,
they,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean that has to be a national movement. There has to be support behind it so parents feel like they're not harming their child by doing it. I mean, I understand that it's a good thing to do. I think they might be afraid that their student is going to be treated badly in school, or that they won't be able to graduate, or there's you know, a lot of fear around that, I imagine.
Yeah.
But I would love to see a student strike on the day of the test.
Oh, I would too. Parents, I would too. I have and I have other persons who are retired teachers or are teachers now who are just dying for the students to go on a strike like they did in Canada.
Right, but it's become normal, you know. It's become normalized. Our kids are just getting used to it.
And, right.
And it's the common sense that, of course, you need a test. How are you going to know if your school's any good if there's no test?
Well, of course, you know, when I took my children out of public school, even though I was committed to public school. But I was just not going to sacrifice them, you know. I just wasn't, and other people joined me, and I never. We had to get permission. I would have to get permission from a parent for a child to be tested. I asked them for permission, and I would never test a child without a parent's permission. Then that is what they should be doing. They should be sued just for that reason alone, that
right.
they are not going and asking the parent if that child can be tested.
Right, and that their data now is becoming public. It's going into a database. It's helping Pearson to design more tests. I didn't sign my kid up for a focus group to help you norm your test.
No.
You know? These are big issues. It also seems like there could be civil rights lawsuits about the testing because it
yes.
really disadvantages brown and black people. It disadvantages low-income people.
Oh, yes.
It's perpetuating a system of inequality, and segregation is increasing because of charter schools and because of the testing and the way that things are, you know, the corporate model is increasing segregation in schools economically and racially, and it seems like it's about time for some civil rights lawsuits. Maybe this is our next big civil rights issue.
Oh, I would love to see that. That would be a wonderful thing if this became a civil rights issue. The entire caring profession, women, nurses, teachers, garbage collectors, all of us who serve, all the public services are just
police
being...
Police officers, firefighters, park
yes,
workers.
Yes, we are all, they're yes. being slammed, and we need to fight back, and it is a civil rights issue. It most definitely is a civil rights issue, and I just hope that it happens, but I don't want to take any of the good news away by harping on this because
the good news, though, is that people are waking up.
Yes.
You know, people are seeing it for what it is. I think this strike, more than anything, got the issues out into the public. Locally, it built tremendous support. Out on the picket line, the number of cars that were honking in support, every city bus that went by, every police car, every fire truck and ambulance, you know, every, you know, worker truck, you know, the guys who are collecting, you know, collect cans in the alleys were giving us support, right? People realized that this is for their kids. They realized that it is against the sort of corporate elitist, you know, neoliberal kind of government that we have in this city and more in this country.
Yes, more and more in this country. Oh, well, I am just so glad that you were there to talk to us, Phil. I really appreciate your time. I know you've been on the strike lines, and I thank your family for sharing you with us. Your wife is a clinical psychologist, and you have three daughters.
Yep, I'll go to Chicago Public Schools.
Yeah. Oh, that's so great.
They go to a fantastic school, and we love it. People love their school in the city. They really do, and I think that's the other reason we have so much support. Parents love their teachers.
Yeah, I could feel that. I could feel it in the videos and in the writing, that there was a lot of love and respect for one another there among the teachers and the parents and the students, and that's wonderful. Oh, and the world is behind you.
Hope we can keep pushing on it.
All right. And I will, if there's anything that you want me to add to this, to the outro, before I launch this, Phil, you can send me an email and I'll add it to the outro. Okay?
Okay. Great.
Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is really neat. I can't wait to see how it comes out.
Oh, it was really my great pleasure.
Great. Thank you so much, and I'm glad I see your stuff on Facebook now, and it's fantastic.
Oh, thanks, Phil.
All right.
Have a good one.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you so very much to Phil Cantor and the Chicago Teachers Union for all their work on behalf of not only the children and families in Chicago, but for we the people and our children in public education everywhere. Jonathan Cozzal, activist and author, will speak in Chicago, the epicenter of the corporate-style education reform storm, on September 27th about his new book, Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America. Cozzal argues that there is a profound connection between urban poverty, racism, and educational neglect. Today, he says, the public schools and teachers who serve children in poverty are under attack. He will address the current unprecedented assault on public education and on public school teachers. This event is hosted by the Children and Family Justice Center of Northwestern University Law School and sponsored by the Chicago Teachers Union. There is a wonderful music video made by a former Chicago Public School student named Rebel Diaz, R-E-B-E-L, first name, D-I-A-Z, second name. It's titled Chicago Teacher, and you can find it on YouTube. Once again, it's titled Chicago Teacher by Rebel Diaz, R-E-B-E-L, D-I-A-Z, on YouTube. The Chicago Teachers Union website is www.ctunet.com. That's C-T-U-N-E-T.com. They do also have a Facebook page. You can just type in there Chicago Teachers Union and you'll find their page on Facebook. Contact information for Phil Cantor. His email is Mr.Cantor, that's lowercase mr.cantor, at gmail.com. Once again, lowercase mr.cantor at gmail.com. He also has a Twitter. It's at Philip Cantor, at PhilipCantor. You can listen and download free anytime at the Education Now website. And please join us on the Education Now Facebook page or our Google Plus page to leave comments and join the conversation. Or send me comments to Hermes at Pacific.net. These are very critical days in education in America. Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education. Our podcasts are listed on the American Montessori Society website at amshq.org. That's three W's dot amshq.org. Look in the local events pages. Sending cosmic love to all and reminding you to follow the child. This is your host, Athena Melville, saying goodbye for now. I'll have another podcast for you on the first Thursday in October.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you